I'm Brandi Cruz. Today on Undivided, Governor Inslee has said a lot of offensive stuff in his 3 terms in office, but I think I have a winner.
Showed more fecklessness than leadership.
Plus, Andrea Suarez with We Heart Seattle joins us to push back against a dangerous narrative around affordable housing. And Democrats in Olympia reject an amendment meant to keep pornographic materials out of our schools.
Pornography books have crept into our schools.
The amendment has failed.
That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Governor Jay Inslee has just said the most divisive thing I've heard him say in 3 terms in office. And if you know me, that's saying a lot. I mean, we've heard this man say a lot of offensive things, a lot of divisive things, a lot of unhinged things, a lot of lies. But there are layers to this story and to what he said that just prove that this man has always been unfit to be the governor of the state of Washington, because he views his job as a him versus everyone else, as Democrats versus everyone else. He sees two classes of people in Washington state. He sees those who agree with him politically and those who don't. And he's always seen it that way. He's gotten more and more brazen, however, as his time in office has dragged on in making that clear. You know, I think back to the days of the pandemic when he called Trump supporters bioreactor facilities who were killing kids in their community if they didn't get a vaccine. I mean, this is a man who, you know, you always hear politicians say, oh, I'll be a president for everyone, or I'll be a governor for everyone. He has no intention of being a governor for everyone. He never did. He's a governor for the people who support his agenda and the people who kowtow to what he wants them to do. And I will tell you this, Bob Ferguson will be no different. He has already shown us that he will be no different. He will follow in Governor Inslee's footsteps, and he will be a governor for the people who agree with him. So I'm going to credit our friend Jonathan Cho with a lot of this reporting. And one of the things I love about what Jonathan Cho is doing is he's covering some very local level issues that, because of the state of the media environment and landscape, often go uncovered. Things that are happening at local city council meetings, for instance, and you have this hyper focus on what's happening in Seattle and in Olympia. But a lot of these fights are being fought in city councils that the media otherwise pays no mind to. So there was a fight going on in the city of Kenmore. Essentially, there had been an approval for a development project that a lot of people had been led to believe would be about housing low-income veterans and the elderly, and it was fairly non-controversial. But then it became clear, a little too late for some, that this was a housing project that would house people who are recovering from drug abuse, who are exiting homelessness. And that brings about very different challenges than if you're housing low-income veterans or low-income seniors. So Jonathan Cho covered this story. Eventually, citizens in Kenmore pushed back so forcefully that the city decided to cancel this Plymouth housing project. But here's a little bit of Jonathan's coverage. And, you know, what he really found out is that at the core of the frustration with citizens in Kenmore was that they were left in the dark until they felt it was too late.
Paul Lee believes it's all by design.
So it seems that they're actually counting on a community that doesn't know, doesn't really care.
He's one of the administrators operating Kenmore Neighbors, one of the most influential community Facebook groups that took on Plymouth Housing last year and convinced the city council to block them from moving into their downtown core.
The CEO seemed like she basically was first to talk and first to leave and didn't care what the community had to say.
Housing First is a very, very effective way to keep people stably housed.
Angry residents claim Plymouth did a bait and switch.
We have to say no. We don't want it.
Selling it initially as affordable housing for veterans and senior citizens.
Look at the people here. Look at how upset we are. Why do we have to go through this?
But then last minute, changed it to apartments for the chronically homeless and drug-addicted individuals.
So after they did that, and after citizens showed up angry to the city council, Kenmore listened to those citizens and said, you know what? You're right. We're not doing it. We're not doing it. It was a bait and switch, and we're not going to allow this Plymouth housing project to move forward. But that was not the end of it. The Democrats who were upset by that went to their friends in Olympia, and their friends in Olympia put forth a bill to try to make sure something like that never happens again, and trying to give the state the power to essentially force local jurisdictions to accept these transitional or supportive housing projects, whether their citizens want them or not. The bill is House Bill 2474. It is still alive in Olympia. It is still very much being debated in Olympia. And it would, you know, encourage cities to go down the path of allowing these types of housing units in their neighborhoods and in their downtown cores. And if they don't agree to do it, it essentially would punish them or try to force them to have these sorts of things in their communities. And we'll have a debate coming up about whether that's appropriate or not. Here's a little bit of testimony in favor of this bill.
This bill would help ensure that our cities are complying with the state statutes and intent to create housing that reduces homelessness.
Sadly, we are seeing unprecedented opposition to new low-income and supportive housing projects more frequently and with more intensity.
Although I support local control is being abused by bad actors in this case.
A fully funded, shovel-ready project that we had been working on for nearly 2 years was hijacked by misinformation and fear-mongering.
Yeah, so we support local control unless you don't agree with us. Then we don't want you to have local control. Then we want to take local control. We think that you're spreading misinformation and you're bad actors if you don't want this housing unit and we want it. That's about how this conversation has gone. So here's the real kicker. And again, what Governor Inslee said about this. So he came out at a press conference. And again, credit to our friend Jonathan Cho for putting this out there. And he had a message to, and he's supporting this bill. He had a message to city leaders in Kenmore who shot this project down.
There is a bill that I think is an important one. It's Bill 2474. This bill would really encourage local leaders to step up to the plate and show some leadership to site housing. This has been a problem. Most recently in Kenmore, we had a site for over 100 housing units ready, set to go, been well worked, financing in place, consistent with local zoning, but local leaders showed more fecklessness than leadership and killed the project.
Fecklessness. Governor Jay Inslee dares to call someone else feckless? You know, and I had to look up the definition of feckless because I know what it means, but I thought, is that really the word he even meant to use? Because it was that offensive. Feckless, lacking initiative or strength of character, irresponsible, useless, worthless, incompetent, inefficient, inept. Feckless. I have never encountered a politician more feckless than the governor. Feckless, by definition, is a governor who pretends not to know that 6 square blocks of the state's largest city has been taken over by left-wing rioters. Feckless is a governor who says absolutely nothing while the campus of his alma mater is taken over by anti-Semites, or while anti-Semites block a freeway for over 5 hours and the governor says nothing. That's feckless. Feckless is not locally elected individuals who listen to their citizens, take those concerns to heart, and do what they believe is best for the people who they are elected to serve. Inslee calls that feckless because he has no freaking idea what it's like to do what's in the best interests of the people he serves. He's never done it. 12 years in office, he's never done it. I want to play something for you that had me, I was in here before the show, listening to it, applauding it. And it's one of the best clips I've ever seen. I'm hard on politicians, but when there's a politician who nails it, I got to give him all the credit in the world. I want you to listen to how the deputy mayor of Kenmore responded to the attacks that they have now endured from Democrats in Olympia, from King County Executive Dow Constantine, and from the governor of the state of Washington who thinks they're feckless.
There's a purpose to having public hearings. and public input. We had substantial public input regarding the Plymouth Project, things that did not come to light without our public. And we had to make a fair, unbiased decision about what was right for the future of our city. And we made one. Listening to our community and being shamed by our county executive and our governor and members of the Democratic Party throughout our region is really galling. We are a democracy. I believe in our community, and we as a council have your back on all sides. Those of you that supported Plymouth, I hear you. But this was a nuanced, incredibly important decision. We cannot shame each other. We must come together. We must listen to each other and bring forward the best decisions and be leaders. Standing back and being shamed for listening to our voters, I'm not going to stand for it. We have a caring, compassionate community that got engaged. When we say your voice matters, it does. It is our duty to listen. So I am thankful to our community. This council has your back, all of you on both sides. This isn't the end of our work for affordability and ending homelessness. This is only the beginning. When we have people coming together, we must keep them engaged so that we can work to create the Kenmore we will always call home.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kenmore Deputy Mayor Melanie O'Kane. I wish every single elected leader had that passion to do what's right for their constituents and to stand up for them and to stand up for themselves when someone like Governor Jay Inslee wants to dictate from the mount what's best for their communities. Go to hell, honestly. I know this is a show called Undivided. What Governor Inslee does and what he says, calling these local elected leaders feckless, believing he knows better than everyone else, is one of the most divisive things happening in this state right now. That's what's divisive. What the city of Kenmore did, what you just heard from the deputy mayor, that's how we bring us back together. By understanding that just because people disagree with you doesn't make them feckless or incompetent, but that being willing to hear, as the city of Kenmore did, from all sides of the issue, making a decision they felt like was in the best interest of what's happening for their city and standing by that decision, even in the face of overwhelming pressure, that is the opposite of feckless. And I applaud them for it. Now listen, this whole debate, for me, really has nothing to do with the central issue at hand. I believe that reasonable people can disagree on whether the state should be able to exert its power in forcing local jurisdictions to allow some of these housing projects to move forward. I think we can have a legitimate debate and dialogue and disagreement on that. But that's not what Governor Inslee wants to have. That's not what Dow Constantine wants to have. That's not what Democrats who are pushing this bill want to have. They don't want to have a conversation about it, about how to work better with communities to make sure that we get some of this housing that we desperately need in our state. They want to shove it down their throats, whether they want it or not, whether it's best for them or not. And they don't want to hear anything about the concerns about it from community members. They'll just accuse those community members, as you heard in the committee testimony, of spreading misinformation, of being bad actors. There is a need for this housing. We are in the midst of a drug crisis. We are in the midst of a homelessness crisis and a mental health crisis. All of it really related, as we're going to talk about coming up in our next segment. And we all want people to get better. We all want them to get back on their feet, and we want them to exit the system. That requires them, in a lot of instances, to get into some sort of supportive housing or transitional housing. And if you don't have that housing, well, there's nowhere for them to go. So it has to go somewhere. But the issue is that in a lot of these instances, you have entities trying to shove that housing onto a community while keeping community members in the dark. And it cannot work that way. It will never work that way. You know, we looked at what happened in the Chinatown International District when Dow Constantine wanted to expand this homelessness complex, and they didn't consult anyone in the Chinatown ID. And what happened? People got so mad, they protested it and pushed back until the county was forced to cancel it at the last minute. I think it was Linwood, where you had something going in next door to a boys and girls club, maybe a methadone clinic or something. And it was a surprise to everyone. They felt like they were left in the dark on purpose. Of course they're going to be upset about it. And then in Kenmore, you had this bait and switch where it's like, hey, you want housing for low-income veterans and the elderly? Well, of course we do. Just kidding, it's going to be for drug addicts and for people who are getting out of homelessness. If the state really wants more communities to be accepting of these sorts of projects, the very best thing for them to do is to encourage transparency, is to encourage public participation and input in the process. But when you call local elected leaders feckless for trying to do just that, for trying to urge transparency, for giving citizens a voice, you are not being a good partner, and you are not going to encourage any jurisdiction to want to work with you on these projects. A lot of this is in the delivery, is in the ability of state lawmakers and the governor not to look down on everyone, but to work with them, to have them at the table, to do what's best for our state and for our communities. But you have elected leaders who don't care. They don't want to do that. That's the problem. So let's fix the way that we have these conversations. Let's include the people who are going to be most impacted by something like that being next door to them. Let's value their opinions, and I promise you, you'll have more communities jumping on board to work with you on this, because it is a net good for our state, and it is something that we need right now. I asked subscribers in our daily subscriber show poll on Patreon, Locals, and X, should the state be able to force local jurisdictions to accept transitional and or permanent supportive housing projects in their communities? A lot of you are saying no. Adorable Deplorable says, and who gets the pleasure of doing the legwork and logistics? And that's an issue too, is, okay, if the state's going to basically say you got to take this, well, how much support are they giving to local communities? For instance, in some of these places where you have homeless individuals who are transitioning out of, you know, life on the streets, you have more crime in the area. That's just a fact of life. Is the state going to give these cities more resources to deal with that and to respond to that? I mean, look back during the pandemic when the city of Kent had this hotel that was scooped up without their knowledge by King County, and they made it into a COVID hotel for the homeless. And then they gave Kent no resources. And you had homeless individuals, this is the very early stage of the pandemic, who were infected with COVID and then leaving the hotel and, you know, going to commit crimes at gas stations down the road. So you want these things, but, and you're going to try to force cities and counties to adopt these things, but are you going to give them any help? Or are you just going to tell them to do it and then deal with any consequences that might arise? So that's a good point. Chris says, I'm not going to read that one because you swore. George says the state has made a terrible job of addressing root causes, such as shoring up our floundering mental health system. Moving people onto my front lawn does not solve the problem. Jones says, absolutely not. All this does is enable their drug-addicted lifestyle. We are loving those people to death. Charles says, I'm in Kent County, so I'm stuck with the insanity no matter what the state does, adding to my list of reasons to move out of state. Hugh says, maybe the poll questions should yield less lopsided results. What if the question were, should transitional and supportive housing be situated near public transportation and jobs and be located throughout the state rather than concentrated in just one area? And I think all of those are legitimate questions and concerns, certainly. But at the very least, you have to be willing to work with the jurisdictions that are going to bear the brunt of these projects, not dictate to them as the governor what they're going to do, and call them feckless if they don't do it. Like I said, most offensive thing I've heard him say in 3 terms. That's a long list, too, of offensive stuff he said. That is the most offensive for all the reasons I just outlined. Coming up next, we're going to kind of stick to this topic, and Andrea Suarez with We Heart Seattle is going to be joining us because there was an op-ed in the Seattle Times that just enraged her, and she has good reason to be upset because it is pushing a false narrative around affordable housing being some sort of solution to homelessness, which it's not. We've been talking about with our friend Zach Abraham about some of the layoffs that are happening with big corporations, Nike, REI, Amazon, Microsoft. They're all laying people off. Meanwhile, you got the stock market that's been doing pretty well. So there's some weird things happening with our economy that just don't line up, like stock market doing well, but the private sector laying a bunch of people off. So what should we expect there? Zach Abraham has said he really believes that despite the stock market, the economy is not in great shape.
people go, well, it's a really strong economy. And you look at them and go, well, you're pumping $2.1 trillion into it a year, yeah, right? So your definition of a strong economy isn't mine, right? You're looking at a four-banger, four-cylinder engine that they hooked up a nitrous oxide tank to, right, and pumped out 800 horsepower, and you guys all act like a miracle has happened, and now we're looking at a Chevy big block V8. No. It's a four-banger on nitrous oxide, right? You pull that out of there, and it's going to decelerate. A lot of this, the vast majority of this economic strength is purely narrative and printed money.
Yeah. And so it's important to have an expert in risk management that's looking at all these economic indicators when they're managing your retirement portfolio, not just, oh, you know, there's a lot of money to be made on the stock market. Well, yeah, but it's not matching up with reality. So let's not go too crazy here. So I suggest having a free Know Your Risk portfolio review with Zach Abraham. He's the chief investment officer at Bulwark Capital. He also hosts the Know Your Risk radio podcast if you want to check it out. Their portfolio review, it's just a great way to see if you're overexposed to risk and you only get one retirement. So why would you not protect it? And I think having someone who's really realistic about the economy, managing your portfolio, especially if you're close to retirement, is the way to go. So schedule your free risk review now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. See, when I read the disclaimer, I read it with zest. I don't think I could read it fast like on the commercials. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered. I do want to note, though, after that first segment, as much as we were sort of angry about the bill itself, my anger is really on the governor and his sanctimony. But Jonathan Cho did report this morning that because of some of the pushback over this, that bill 2474 has died as of this morning in the Washington state legislature, did not make it out of the Senate committee. And that is just another example of what happens when you have people who are informed. I mean, look what happened in the city of Kenmore. That thing would be full steam ahead had citizens not gotten wise to what was going on. The same thing with the homelessness complex in SoDo. Full steam ahead had individuals in SoDo not held protests and demanded that they be consulted before anything is done. So citizens have an awful lot of power to influence policy and to change the direction of things. They just need to find their voice and to have people listen to their voice. I give Jonathan Cho a lot of credit. I gave him credit for killing the homelessness complex in SoDo by being there with a camera and a microphone and letting these people tell their stories and by documenting what's been happening up in the city of Kenmore. So this bill has died. I wouldn't put it past them to try it again next year. But the sentiment from the governor and from Democrats in Olympia is still very much alive. And that isn't changing anytime soon, that they know best. And if you don't do what they want you to do, then you're feckless, worthless, incompetent, NIMBY, you name it. Okay, on this subject, there was an op-ed in the Seattle Times about the homelessness crisis, and it peddles a theory that is just false. It is just false. We've been talking about it for years. There is no data, no information you could give me that would convince me that our homelessness crisis is simply because people can't afford housing. One of the dumbest narratives, one of the laziest narratives. And this was from Naomi Ishaka in the Seattle Times columnist. Why are people homeless in Seattle? Look upstream, she argues. You can point to a lot of reasons why so many people in Seattle live unsheltered, but here's the bottom line. The rents are too damn high. So again, this whole article wants to take this back to, oh, if there was only affordable housing for these people to be in. Now, We Heart Seattle and Andrea Suarez responded to this a few times. And look, I've seen a lot of unhinged articles from the Times, both the op-ed side and the newsroom on homelessness that perpetuate this false narrative. But this one really caught Andrea's eye. And as you're going to hear from her momentarily, was infuriating because this narrative is leading to people's deaths. She responded to the Seattle Times article and said, gosh, this article is so misleading. We all must bifurcate the need for lower income affordable housing and recovery housing solutions for the homeless depicted tying tents up to a fence here. Come walk with us, Naomi, and interview why people are on the streets. It's drugs, by the way. And what she's pointing to is you've got this article with the Times op-ed, although I think it's a similar sentiment to what the newsroom side of things in the Times acquiesces to this narrative from the governor. And you're showing a picture of these tents, you know, tied up to a fence, as if the people wouldn't be living in those hellish conditions in tents if there was only an affordable place for them to live. Now, Andrea knows that's not true because she has made it her mission to get out there and figure out what's happening with these people in the tents. She actually goes out to the encampments. She actually talks to them. And it is drugs and mental health, or both, that leaves people living in those conditions. We spend billions on homelessness. If you are someone who is falling into homelessness simply because you cannot afford a place to live, you can go to any number of nonprofits and government contractors and get a place to live like that. And if you can't, that's a true failure of our system. But Andrea Suarez, we asked her to come on this morning to talk to us about why she was so frustrated with this Seattle Times op-ed. But then it just so happened, as she was, just before we were about to tape with her, a homeless couple, Kevin and Emily, they stopped by Andrea's We Heart Seattle office in downtown Seattle. And it was such a perfect example of the frustration that Andrea has with this Times narrative. Here's a cell phone video that Andrea took of this couple.
Hey, you guys just walked into my office. I haven't seen you in a minute. It's been a few months, but I've known you since Denny Park when you guys were living in a tent in the park. Emily and
Kevin.
Emily and Kevin. And we're talking today about what is the number one barrier that's keeping you guys from affording an apartment? Is it high rent? What is the immediate barrier that's keeping you from taking the next step towards housing?
Drugs,
Naomi. Drugs, Seattle Times. Drugs, Governor Inslee. You don't have to believe me. You don't have to believe Andrea. Hell, you don't even have to believe your own eyes when you go walk down Third Avenue, or really the downtown in any city in our state. But you sure as hell should believe it straight from the horse's mouth when they tell you that they would have a roof over their head if not for drugs. Who else do you have to hear it from to shut up about this narrative? A narrative that is killing people. Killing people. Anyway, Andrea came on to respond to the Seattle Times op-ed. Andrea, welcome back to Undivided.
Thank you. Good morning, Brandy.
Yeah, the Seattle Times has, I think, long bought into this narrative that's pushed that the homelessness crisis is simply a lack of affordable housing. I think they've been doing that for a long time. So why did this particular article in the Times strike you?
The headline should be, any amount of rent is too high for somebody with untreated mental illness and substance abuse disorder. It's just so disingenuous and naive to publish something like that, showing tents tied up to the fence as if it was high rent that put them there. If the Seattle Times would spend more time boots on the ground in and out of these low barrier housing units, they'd see that free rent or $25 a month rent or low barrier of any kind is simply putting people indoors in the same squalid conditions as they are outdoors. It's doing the very people we're all trying to serve a huge disservice when something like that is published. And you can see through public opinion why it went viral, my comments, because people are sick and tired of this narrative. It's harming our neighbors, our community, our economy.
And as you said, boots on the ground. No one's had more boots on the ground than you have. And you've seen firsthand what people are dealing with in tents and also what they're dealing with in housing. You sent us some pictures this morning of a story that I think illustrates the point you're making very well. Share it with everyone.
Yeah, one of our clients we met in a Woodland Park in a tent. He's been in and out of detox many times. He finally got into housing, which was $25 a month. We went and visited him. There was feces, blood, vomit, foils everywhere, squalid living conditions, rotting food. And I said no more. We got him an ambulance and coordinated with family back in Spokane and got him home. And, you know, it's just a perfect example of he wasn't even paying his $25 a month rent. We were trying to prevent him getting evicted through that. And it's over and over and over again. We've been in and out of Catholic Community Service, Plymouth Housing, Tiny House Villages, they're trying under failed policy to do the right thing. Don't hate the player, hate the game. And I know these folks are working really hard. You know, we talk about burned out staff and low wages. It's the unintended consequence of failed harm reduction and housing first policy that's burning people out. You can't succeed under these policies, and it's killing people right in front of our eyes, indoors and outdoors.
Yeah, it's a perfect illustration of something I've said, you know, about my own father who dealt with substance abuse and homelessness. We could have put him in a $1 million mansion. He still would have died drug addicted and mentally ill. And so I guess, what do you think is the motivation? Is it just ideological for the Times to continue to push what is a false narrative?
It's like an unwillingness to be more curious and truly bifurcate housing for low-income veterans, single families. I think we're all in agreement. Yes, more affordable housing, public transportation and bus lines and that kind of infrastructure should allow people to get into their downtown jobs that are gig workers. We've built all that infrastructure. Not everybody can live downtown, right? So we build all that transportation. So we've sort of solved it there. Housing for the street homeless that we see living rough, overdosing on our streets, suffering, living in these squalid living conditions, or this Hooverville that's in Soto, she made reference to, this is completely separate. The housing and healthcare crisis is a separate conversation. If you want to buy a hotel, make those hospital rooms, turn them into a place for respite and detox, bring in the National Guard. This is a state of emergency. People are dropping like flies, 115 overdose reversals a week that are reported by Seattle Fire Department. So just bifurcate the two. All she has to do, all Seattle Times has to do, is say we're talking about two different things.
Yeah.
That's it. All you got to do is do that. The statistics quoted, these under 20% statistic that this homelessness is rooted in mental health and substance abuse disorders is egregiously false.
Yeah.
100% of people tied to those fences are on fentanyl. Or Fetty Rock. In fact, fentanyl addicts are like, it's not even fentanyl pills anymore. It's Fetty. Go out and learn. Get out there and tour these homes. Get into the camps. Get to know people and their stories. And you'll realize this has nothing to do with high rent.
Yeah. And it's shocking to me that, as you say, that people aren't bifurcating this by now. Of course, we have an affordable housing crisis in Washington state. People, you know, two-income households that are working class can't afford to buy a house. That's an affordable housing crisis. But it is much different than what's facing people who choose to live in squalor in a tent on a sidewalk surrounded by trash and feces. I mean, how many dead people, Andrea, have you found personally?
Our volunteers have found 12 people in RVs, cars, tents. The pictures I sent you earlier, that man would not have lasted another 4 hours, according to the paramedics. So people are being left there to languish and die. I don't understand why we are not putting all outreach, any outreach that's funded. I'm talking Urban League, Catholic Community Services, REACH. We need everybody outside marching through our streets into the camps. I know they are to a degree, but we need more. We need more people. There's something wildly wrong that at least WeHeart Seattle is going within 20 feet of the tent, knocking on the van door, knocking on the RV, saying, anybody home, welfare check, and finding out that people have not just been passed away for a minute, but years. We found a man down to the skeleton right on Dexter Ave in urban downtown Seattle, steps from residential communities. There's something egregiously wrong with the don't go on slopes and don't go within 20 feet of a tent policy. Stop it now. Full stop.
It's a disgusting lack of, well, they call it empathy. It is the opposite of empathy. Everything that the city of Seattle is doing, everything that Washington State is doing. I wanted to ask you, Andrea, because I've never got a chance. You know, we had broke this news back in the fall about Governor Inslee's right-of-way initiative, where they were spending money to clear encampments along state highways, essentially, and then try to get people out of homelessness. And the figure that we revealed based on state data is, so they spent $143 million for the first, you know, go about with this. And it cost them about $1 million per person to get them out of one of those encampments and out of the homelessness system, as they characterize it. What could WeHeart Seattle do with $143 million?
We would build 6-month recovery oriented housing, much like the Salvation Army has, rinse, repeat, Anybody that's through recovery, I'm really looking forward to having Tom Wolf on your show in a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. It's a 6-month mandatory, whether it's court ordered or your family won't take you back or your job won't take you back. No one's going to do it on their own. It shouldn't be faith-based. Love Salvation Army, but rinse, repeat, build those hotels into 6-month adult recovery programs. With programming like litter picking and yoga and coloring and 12-step, whatever that looks like, but there has to be something for people to do every day. Last week on Valentine's Day, I had 25 men from Plymouth Housing show up for basic needs stipends to pick up more than 10,000 pounds of trash for us. They're like, thank you for giving us something to do all day. People indoors, outdoors are begging for something to do. They're sick and tired of being coddled and frankly, collateral damage for broken ideology.
Yeah. Andrea, what is it going to take? I mean, what is it going to take to, when you've got the newspaper of record, what are you pointing to? Oh, vote. Your pin that says vote. That is what it's going to take. Andrea,
education, you know, it's voter education. Our direct action is these organized litter picks that unveil, you know, why was there 1 million pounds of trash? Why were there 35,000 needles? Why are there 12 dead bodies? To our undivided voters, get out, get educated, and vote. And maybe We Heart Seattle and our platform is a de facto voter guide, a pamphlet, if you will. You know, we're looking at forming a 501c4 so that we can scream from the mountaintops who to elect, what lobby and policy you should be voting for. And but you have to get educated. And the best way to get educated is to get out and learn for yourself. Join a nonprofit, go volunteer at a pantry, go volunteer with We Heart, or form your own community-based direct action. Maybe it's security-oriented, a block-by-block approach, and see what's working and what's not. Because like that Seattle Times article, you cannot believe everything you read.
No. Yeah, and it shouldn't be, I mean, to me, you say voter guide and stuff, a huge red flag, maybe number one red flag, if you care about seeing the homelessness crisis solved, is don't vote for someone who says it's an affordability crisis. That's like, for me, red flag number one, to that person is not going to be able to solve a dang thing. Andrea, before I let you go, I want to ask you one quick thing about a story we just discussed on the podcast, because it's sort of in your area of expertise. You mentioned Plymouth Housing. There is a lot of anger from some communities right now. You know, Kenmore was supposed to get a Plymouth Housing facility. They shut it down at the last minute. Now it might go to Redmond, but state lawmakers Democrats are trying to push through a bill that would basically say you've got to do it, or we're going to try to take funding from you. So trying to put these facilities in communities that might not want them. Do you think that's an effective way to go about it? I'm assuming you've been tracking this. So do you have any particular thoughts on it?
Well, I mean, a recent example is the Central District encampment that's completely surrounding a school district, a daycare center and small businesses. And right there is a King County low barrier housing complex, and all the dealers know where their customers are. And that's the fear, is you're going to attract this ecosystem of various criminal behavior, dealing, sex trafficking, squalid living conditions, and everybody sets up camp where their customers are. And a lot of those people that are outside those housing complexes aren't unhoused. They frankly live there, but they come outside and they still, you know, harm the community overall. So what I'd love to see, and excuse me, London Breed just did this in San Francisco, bold move. She required that low barrier hotel that they put in their Chinese International District, people be enrolled in drug and alcohol counseling. They have to be enrolled in a 12-step program. Meet the compromise. I think if there is a compromise there, that this is a progressive housing unit where there's a requirement to enroll and reach self-sufficiency, that the community should then therefore accept that, because we got to give people a chance and a hand up. So I'd love to see these housing projects be turned into adult recovery centers with mandated enrollment into drug and alcohol 12-step program of some kind.
Yeah, and keep the community informed. You know, don't, like in Soto when they had the homelessness complex, King County was trying to ram down their throats without input. You know, that's never going to be met well by a community. And so be transparent with them. Talk to them about it every step of the way. Be realistic about what the possible consequences of it might be and how you plan to deal with those consequences. It's the secrecy and the pushing through of things that is never going to work in a community. So, Andrea, you're the best.
Thank you, Brandy. I just want to tie off my message to King County Regional Housing Authority and our leadership is to fund outreach or demand that the existing outreach compassionately intervene on the ground. Forget about housing. Triage right then and there before arrest to detox, through motivational interviewing, through gentle persuasion. It's time. Fentanyl will kill you in 2 years. Let us take you on a path towards detox, Oxford Housing, Weld Housing, Pioneer Human Services Housing, Battlefield Addiction, Remnant Army. There is a ton of places for people to go once they're discharged. That's the path out. More assertive, compassionate intervention forward outreach. Start there, not top down, bottom up, ground up with outreach.
100% common sense. Man, if I were the governor, I'd be taking my checkbook, taxpayer checkbook, and I'd be signing over all $143 million from my failed efforts over to Andrea Suarez and WeHeart Seattle.
Or just change the policy.
They're not going to do that, but yes. Okay. I would love you dictating the state policy because I think we'd be in a much better place. Andrea Suarez, we appreciate it.
Thanks. Have a great day.
I love Andrea. Truth teller. That's all we need. We need some people who are willing to go down, do the hard work, see things for themselves, and then tell the truth. Why can't we have more politicians who tell the truth? And look, I know that I've been hard on people today. And I have a show called Undivided, and invariably I get these responses from no-name people on social media like, doesn't seem very undivided to me, Brandy. What is dividing us are people like the governor, who calls local elected leaders feckless because they don't do what he wants them to do. What's dividing us are outlets like the Seattle Times that push a narrative that is completely false on homelessness, so much so that that's all everyone focuses on, and we don't fix the actual problem, and so people die. That's what's dividing us. We have to cut through these narratives, these ideologies that are doing nothing but dividing our communities and pulling us further and deeper into the gutter. And so, yes, I will be hard on them because they are those policies being driven by ideology, outlets like the Times that just fall right in line, are attributing so much to the divisive nature of our political discourse and the ineffective nature of our political discourse. Because you have someone like Andrea Suarez who's like, hey, here's some pictures of what happens when you put a drug addict in affordable housing. Here's a video of two homeless people who've been offered housing a billion times and say they don't want it because they want to be using drugs. So you've got that, but then you've got the governor, and you've got others in power, and you've got the Seattle Times, the newspaper of record, saying, yeah, but that's not true. And then people just choose to believe who aligns more with their ideology. And reality doesn't even factor into the equation. So you want to know how we get undivided? It's by shutting down the insanity. And that can include the media, and that can include politicians. And I would just note that this isn't getting any better. This is getting worse, and more people are going to be dying. It is never too late to change course. You know, down in Oregon, I saw this story today. We know that overdoses have been awful in Washington State as well. In Oregon, fentanyl deaths, they're up 1,500%. 1,500%. That's the largest increase in the United States. Not a coincidence that Oregon also experimented with decriminalizing drugs. So this isn't plateauing. This isn't easing. It's getting worse. And until politicians and newspapers get their heads out of their you-know-whats and focus on reality over ideology, more people are going to die. So you get to decide. You get to decide right now, today. Do you want to help save lives? Or do you want to help kill people? It's not a divide between left and right. It's not a divide between Democrat and Republican. It is a divide between reasonable and unreasonable. That's the fight we're fighting. I know what side you're on. I know what side I'm on. I know what side Nicole's on. And each of us has to do a better job of recruiting people to that side. All right, coming up next in our segment Unbelievable, Democrats in Olympia actually voted down an amendment that's only purpose was to keep porn out of schools. Yeah, not making that up. That's true. It happened. We'll talk about it. First, I've been urging you guys to become members of the First Mark family. Everyone needs insurance. Everyone has insurance needs. Rather than shopping the market on your own, rechecking every year to see, do I have the best rate? Do I have the coverage I need? Why would you not have a local company do that for you for free? That's what Mike and I do with First Mark Insurance. We took the First Mark Challenge about a year ago. I've heard from so many of you who have taken the challenge as well. Some have moved on to become members of the First Mark family. Others, they had perfectly good insurance. First Mark told them so and said, you just keep doing you. You don't even need us. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. Dave Taylor, the CEO of First Mark, says one of the big benefits of working with them is that's a lot of time commitment to shop the market, and they can do it for you.
You want to know you're getting a competitive price. How else do you do that unless you're willing to yourself shop 10 different insurance companies to find out?
Right.
Right. Do you trust your agent at one of these captive carriers? So get a competitive price. And the best way to do that is have a broker, again, like First Mark, shop the market for you.
Yeah. And he mentioned captive carriers there. If you don't know what that means, there are some insurance brokers who they only sell insurance from a specific company. That's not what First Mark is. First Mark has a bunch of carriers they can go to make sure they're getting you the best price and the best coverage for what you need. So take the First Mark challenge today. It's free. It takes you like maybe an hour of your time. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. They work for you, not the insurance companies, which is the best part. You notice I'm always so sanctimonious when I pitch First Mark because it really is like, why would you not do it? And it doesn't cost you anything, guys. It's one of my only advertisers. It doesn't cost you anything. Okay, Democrats in Olympia blocked a proposed amendment that would have done one simple thing. It would have said that schools can't have pornographic content in their libraries or in their classrooms. What? Seems easy, right? No, but Democrats said, we can't have that. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Okay, so we've talked about this effort. There's a Senate version of the bill. There's a House version of the bill. The House version of the bill is 2331, and it's that inclusive curriculum bill. And it would say that the state is going to mandate that school districts across the state have inclusive curriculum. So this might be inclusive for the LGBTQ community, inclusive for students of different races and backgrounds, inclusive for neurodiverse students, etc. So essentially, it wants to make every school district in the state embrace what Seattle has embraced, this DEI, gender ideology sort of curriculum. So there was a hearing on this in the Education Committee over in the Senate. Senator Jim McCune, who is a Republican, introduced what seems like a pretty non-controversial amendment, and it would just say, okay, like you can have your inclusive curriculum, but no porn. Nothing pornographic in nature for our kids. Like, okay, that seems totally reasonable. It says it would prohibit school boards from approving the use of any textbook, instructional material, supplemental instructional material, or other curriculum for student instruction if it contains erotic material, sexually explicit material, or lewd material. And the amendment did go on to define those further, like what does lewd and sexually explicit mean, but we don't have to go through each and every one of those. And this isn't just some manufactured, crazy Republican senator suggesting that we're, you know, reading materials to kids that are pornographic. No, this is happening. He gave a couple book examples, but I just want to point out that we've talked about this on the show. We had a mom, you might remember this was a few months ago, her son's a 10th grader at Lincoln High School in Wallingford in Seattle, and their class had to do a reading of a short story called My Crazy African Mother. Do you remember this? Where it was like this girl, I mean, I'll read part of it. Her mom's an African immigrant. She's a first generation American. She's trying to like become more Americanized, I guess. So she has this boy over and he's feeling her up on the couch and she doesn't want him to, but he just keeps doing it. It says, he pushes me back, pulls my shirt up so it bunches around my neck, takes my bra off. I feel a sudden coolness on my exposed upper body, sticky, warm moistness on my breast. I once read a book where a man sucked his wife's breast so hard he left nothing for the baby. Matt is sucking like that man. Like, this is just part of it. And then it goes on to talk about her mom catches her and makes her undress from the waist down, lay on her bed with her legs open, and she threatens to put a hot pepper in her vagina. This was read to 10th graders. This student told his mom that girls in the classroom felt so uncomfortable, some wanted to get up to leave, but they weren't allowed to. So this is happening in schools. You have completely inappropriate, sexually explicit content being read to kids. Now, Senator McCune, in his testimony about his amendment, he gave two specific examples, and he didn't even want to read from the books because he said that it was uncomfortable. One of the books is called Jack of Hearts. This is the description on the author of this book's website. Jack has a lot of sex, and he's not ashamed of it. While he's sometimes ostracized and gossip constantly rages about his sex life, Jack always believes that it could be worse. But then the worst unexpectedly strikes when Jack starts writing a teen sex advice column for an online site. He begins to receive creepy and threatening love letters that attempt to force Jack to curb his sexuality and his personality. Now it's up to Jack and his best friends to uncover the stalker before their love becomes dangerous. He also gave the example of a book called All Boys Aren't Blue. And I went on to kind of read about this book, and I was reading this study guide for it, and it gave a content warning on an online study guide. All Boys Aren't Blue contains sensitive material that may be difficult for some readers. This includes racial slurs, racism, physical and sexual abuse, injury and death, graphic depictions of sexual encounters, bullying and harassment, and anti-LGBTQ language and sentiments. Gee, graphic depictions of sexual encounters? Physical and sexual abuse? So here's Jim McCune wrapping up his testimony on why it would be important to just simply add an amendment to this already controversial bill about inclusive learning that says, hey, no pornographic stuff in our schools.
Pornography books have crept into our schools and our school libraries. This kind of printed visual material of dirty sexual talk and pictures of sexual activity and have no place in our K-12 schools at all.
Yeah, Senator, I agree with you. And I think anyone with an ounce of common sense and sanity agrees with you too, except apparently not Senator Lisa Wellman, who is the chair of this particular education committee.
For someone who has been so often in favor of local control, you are saying that you want the state to override the local control of your local superintendent and the process that is in place to review curriculum and to determine whether it falls into the category that you've said. And for that reason, because I believe that there is local control procedures in place to do exactly that. And I would like to know what school has that. We can look to it in another term. But I am asking, we need to move forward. I'm asking for a no on this this amendment. And so all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Nay.
The amendment has failed.
This stuff is unreal. And so she won't even let him give a retort to this. And that was, yes, Democrats on an education committee rejecting an amendment that's only purpose was to make sure that sexually explicit content is not being foisted upon children in K-12 public schools. So that's what you just saw. But I would also say to Senator Wellman, you just made an argument against the entirety of that bill. She tried to use the conservative sort of idea that local control is best and that's what you hear Republicans, and that is a good point, push for on educational issues. Like, hey, let's leave it to local control. And she says, well, you argue for local control, but you don't want local school districts to control whether there's pornography being taught to students. But in doing that, in saying, she says, I think there's local control, she's undermining the entirety of the bill. Because remember the underlying bill that they're discussing. The underlying bill that they're discussing is taking local control away from all the school districts in the state and saying that the state is going to dictate a certain set of inclusivity standards for what kids learn. So she's totally undermined the entire bill. Either you believe in local control or you don't, but also the idea that if you believe in local control, everything has to be local control is also a fallacy. If you're going to say that, then you're going to say that, DUI laws, each individual city can decide how drunk is too drunk for someone to drive. you know, murder laws or self-defense laws. Each individual city can decide whether someone, you know, engaged in an act of self-defense when they shot an intruder. No, there are certain things where it's okay. You know, let's have statewide rules around this. We have a lot of that with education, some statewide expectations that are reasonable. And then let's leave the rest up to local school districts to do what they see best. But in a situation of pornographic content, why would there be a, there shouldn't be any discussion about whether any local school would have a reason on a local level, on a case-by-case basis, to insert pornographic content into lessons. Why would that have to be something that's left up to local control when it's just universally should be agreed that, hey, that's kind of weird. Yeah, let's not read these sorts of books to kids in public schools, even if they're seniors. Democrats actually rejected an amendment to keep pornographic content away from kids. It's unfreaking believable. Oh, it's unbelievable. You got to laugh so you don't cry. Coming up next, we'll dip outside of Washington State just briefly, see what's happening over in New York with the migrant crisis and a program to make sure that not only are those migrants and asylum seekers fed, but they have money to buy the cuisine that is more closely aligned with where they came from. If that makes sense, we'll discuss. First, I've been talking to our friend Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com about the state of the real estate market. So if you're thinking about buying or selling a home, Wes always has great advice on this end. But the interest rates were not great in 2023. And so certainly for people who could wait, they did. Didn't want to buy a home with interest rates so high. And for that reason, people weren't selling their homes either. So the question is the Fed going to drop interest rates this year? They didn't do it a few weeks ago, but Wes thinks that because it's a presidential election year, there's probably going to be some pressure on the Fed to bring rates down so people feel better about the state of the economy.
They say that the Fed and the presidency, you know, they're not supposed to influence each other. But let's be honest. Come on. They're not supposed to.
Right.
But they do. So, you know, Biden's administration is going to do whatever they can to put whatever pressure they can, you know, on the Fed to keep lowering interest rates down, because that's what it's going to make the American population happy and allow people to get into ownership, or at least give them, you know, give them that peace of mind.
Yeah. And if you're a home seller, you can't really do anything about that, right? You can't control the Fed. You can't control what Biden tells the Fed to do. You can just sit back and wait and see what happens. Or you can also get ready in the meantime. You can get your home ready for when that eventuality does occur and rates go down and then the market is all of a sudden popping off again. And you're not sitting there like, oh, okay, I'm going to list my home now, but I've got to make all these updates to it and that might take a few months. No, get ready now. Reach out to Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com. He and his team, not only do they have awesome marketing materials that they put out there for their clients, but they also have something called the Listing Boost Concierge Service, where they're going to come in if you need to do cosmetic updates to your home. They're going to help manage those projects if you need them to. They can even pay for it up front. So ask Wes and his team about that. Sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. You know, sometimes, though, I'm like, maybe the real estate market, it's interesting where it happens. Like, we had a house in our neighborhood go up for sale, which was a very stressful experience. Because you never want to get new neighbors. Unless, like, you hate the neighbors that are moving out. But it's like the devil you... I'm not saying the guy who moved out was the devil. He was a nice guy. Mm-hmm. But the devil you know versus the one you don't know. So we're all sitting there, all of us, our neighbors, like, who's coming for the home, you know, for the visits? Who's like... And, you know, we saw a couple of people who were like, definitely from Seattle. We're like, what should we do? You know, should we go over there and just like, leave? No, but the house sold in like 2 days. And I was like, okay. So there are some areas where it's mm-hmm. like people, you know, you can only wait so long. There are some people who don't have a choice but to put their home on the market, regardless of where the Fed has interest rates. And you can always refi. Anyway, tangent. Come on. I'm not the only one who's like seen people coming to an open house in their neighborhood and been like, I don't want Absolutely. You to move here. Right. Maybe that's a little judgy, a book by a cover, whatever. You don't fit in, okay? No, it was just, I'm totally kidding. I'm sure they were perfectly nice. It was like a really young couple. They looked like maybe they had listened to loud music. And I was like, get off my lawn, you know? I just want some nice, quiet families.
Young people, you know? Were not okay.
They were really young. Hilarious. They were really young. I was they're like, they're having house parties for sure. Uh-huh. Anyway, okay. We'll fit one national story in over in New York City. Just wild to see. And what's happening in New York around the asylum seekers and the migrant crisis, this is going to be happening everywhere else. They're just ahead of unfortunately, ahead of the game. I mean, you had a lot of the asylum seekers bus to New York before they were bused anywhere else. And so Chicago's starting to experience what New York is experiencing. We know we have asylum seekers being brought here. So what we're seeing happen in New York, I would not rule out happening here in the not so distant future if the country doesn't get a grasp on what's going on. So this from the New York Post. New York City launches $53 million program to hand out prepaid credit cards to migrant families. It says the amount on each card will vary depending on the size of the family and whether any income is coming in, according to the details of the contract, which no income is going to be coming in because if you're here seeking asylum, you don't have some ability to work. It says a family of four, for instance, could be provided nearly $1,000 each month, which comes out to $35 per day for food. Cards will get refilled every 28 days. The city is housing just over 66,000 asylum seekers after 1,500 more arrived last week as part of a crisis that is expected to cost $10 billion through 2025. So there are some interesting aspects to this. One of the things I saw is that, so right now, the asylum seekers who are going to be getting these cards, they're being housed at hotels already. So you already have them being put up, given shelter in hotels by the taxpayers of New York City. And now the taxpayers are also going to be providing them with cards every month that have up to $1,000 for food. One of the interesting things is New York City was already paying the bill for their food through the hotels. So New York City is actually arguing, hey, if we give them these cards, it'll actually be less expensive than the meals that we're currently providing them that they don't like. It says the city has been shelling out about $11 per meal to feed migrant families in hotels, something that's long posed a problem as some asylum seekers from various countries in Central and South America and Africa may be looking for a taste of home. Just last month,
chicken strips and fries. Not
the controversial company DocGo was found to be wasting thousands of dollars on uneaten meals. Migrants confessed to the Post in the days after that they would rather cook in their hotel rooms because the provided meals were so, quote, bad. And it goes on elsewhere to say they want meals that are more customary to what they used to eat at home. Now, look. I'm trying to figure out how to not sound like a horrible human being. I guess I don't care if the meals are what you're used to eating at home because you came here. And so it's like you left those meals behind. Now, if the city of New York is content on paying for their meals anyway, and they already were, and you're telling me that the city of New York will save more money by giving them these cards where they can go out shopping on their own, I guess that's fine. The other question I had, though, is how do they know that these cards are going to be spent on food? And it said that they would have to basically sign some agreement saying that it says the cards can only be used at bodegas, grocery stores, supermarkets, and convenience stores, and migrants must sign an affidavit swearing that they will only spend the funds on food and baby supplies or they'll be kicked out of the program. Okay, thousands of migrants on this program.
That's a lot of people to keep track of.
Who's going to check?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to check. And it's similar to SNAP, to food stamp benefits. And you have people, I don't think it happens a lot, but you have people who sell their food stamp benefits like for, you know, pennies on the dollar and then use that money for something else, probably drugs. And then somebody else uses the SNAP cards for actual food. So to think that's not going to happen, and genuinely, who is going to check? Who is going to ask for receipts? No one. So it's just the honor system. And this whole thing has gotten completely out of control. I mean, once you're here, once you've said come here, once you've welcomed them on their bus and said welcome to New York City, I guess it's like, well, either we can house them in a hotel and feed them or they can be out living on the streets and taking up shelter space when we already have a homeless crisis. So it's like at this point, you're so far past, you can't reverse. Mm-hmm. I asked this of subscribers a couple weeks ago, like, would you rather have the asylum seekers who come to Seattle just be housed up front or have them fall into the homeless industrial complex where they might end up along a state highway and Governor Inslee is going to spend $1 million per person to get them off that highway. I almost rather have you just put them in a homeless hotel up front as much as that just encourages the behavior, but they're going to accept them anyway. It's Washington State. It's New York City. You've got sanctuary cities. So it's like, how do you ease the burden on taxpayers? What is the end point?
What's the end point? So we just keep, I mean, are we giving them opportunities to make their own money and buy their own meals and buy whatever they want?
But why
are we
would
giving
they?
Them? Yeah. I know exactly. Are we encouraging that? Are we? I mean, there's no end point right now for any of this.
No,
I don't get it.
And then you're saying that if they are making money, you're going to give them less money on the card. So there's no motivation there.
No.
And you're in a hotel in New York City, which I don't know if you've ever been to New York City. Even the crap hotels are like $400 a night. It is very expensive to find a hotel in New York City. So, and then meanwhile, I mean, they were talking about in the Post how low-income New York City residents got like a similar credit card, prepaid card, if they couldn't afford holiday meals, but it was like a one-time thing. Mm-hmm. So New York City wants to hold that up as, oh no, we did that for taxpayers too. It's like, you gave them a little bit of money to help pay for a holiday meal. You're giving these undocumented migrants up to $1,000 a month and paying for their lodging. So you're doing more for people who don't pay into the system.
Right.
It's quite ridiculous.
And I mean, there's also been all the videos of, there was another attack on police in one of the housing things. There was it's out of control. There's no rhythm, no plan, no nothing. No. They're just throwing money at the problem, throwing space at the problem. And I don't see
And there's no reason for them to stop coming. If that's what they're getting, they're not going to stop coming. No. They're going to keep coming. And where is the end of it? And that's mm-hmm. the billion, probably trillion-dollar question at this point. Mm-hmm. Okay, before we get to questions and comments, going long today. I mean, Nicole, we might just have to do a 90-minute show. I mean, I can't always say we're just going long. You said yesterday you thought it was our longest show ever.
I think it was.
And we went into it being like, I don't know if we have enough today. And it was like, apparently I just, blah, 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 just word soup. Okay, I've been talking about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, down, I think, 39 pounds now. I got to reweigh myself. 39, I believe. I'm feeling amazing. And also, gosh, in combination with all that increased energy I got from losing weight, now I've been working out and I feel
buff.
I mean, you know, I always tell Mike, I said, poke it, do it. So I didn't have the energy to work out when I was out. You know, I was wanting to like, I didn't have the energy to work out when I had all that excess weight. But anyway, as much as I like talking about my success on the program, I also love hearing about your success. Denise says, with Eastside Weight Loss Clinic's guidance and support, I lost 30 pounds in the 60-day reduction phase and am now only about 20 pounds from my ultimate goal weight. I went from being unhealthy and obese to sleeping better, moving more, and having more energy. More energy. Like I said, it's the key. Okay, let me read one more of these. I got so many. Kristen M. says she lost 20 pounds in 8 weeks. Life-changing program. It was easy to follow, which was key for me. Eastside Weight Loss was the best investment I've made for myself in years. Love it, Kristen. If you want to try the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, first start by just seeing if it's right for you. Not every weight loss program is going to be right for every person. So schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team at eastsideweightlossclinic.com. That's Eastside Weight Loss. Clinic.com. Okay, let's get to questions and comments from the live stream before we get to our closing sanity check on the city of Kenmore canceling the Plymouth housing project. Sherry Morgan Calderon says they were right to shoot down his self-imposed housing problem band-aid. No more taxes, Inslee. Read our lips. Tracy Sack says, I'm a Kenmore resident. Our issue was the low barrier housing. We have plans for affordable housing in the community plan. And that is a good point, that when you have low barrier housing, so what you're saying is you can still be using drugs while you're in the housing. And I think there is a space for having to have some low barrier housing, because otherwise people are never going to accept it if they can't continue to do drugs there. Although I would much rather have a situation where you have to be, as a condition of the housing, in drug treatment. And so Tracy wants to make the point that, hey, we don't have an issue with housing individuals who are trying to get off the streets, but we had a lot of concerns about low barrier housing and what that might bring to the community. Ron Bishop says, 328 days left in Inslee's term, but who's counting? All of us. Y says housing is not the reason why people are homeless, and demonizing property owners is not going to help to have more housing, especially when people take advantage of them and this failing system of ours. E says, love your passion today. 100% support to Kenmore City Council. Wish we had that here in Seattle. Most people in Seattle don't want what gets passed in Seattle and only 19% vote, which is why the insanity continues. I think if you don't vote, you do want what's passed. Honestly, if you don't care that much, then you do want it. Then it can't bother you so much. It can't bother you because if it bothered you, you'd vote. On homelessness and Andrea Suarez, Liz said, if people were sane or sober, they would stay in shelter or with family while they get on their feet. Exactly. Tim says, total failure of the public schools. Huge populations are not ready to enter adult life and pay their own bills. The welfare system can't grow large enough to cover the social contagion of irresponsibility fueled by the Washington majority. That's a good point. You think it's bad now, this irresponsibility? I mean, look what's happening with youth. It's going to be terrible. There is no social safety net big enough or deep enough. On the porn amendment that was killed, I've said porn so many times in this video, it's probably going to get taken off YouTube. Bill Biz with a $20 super chat. Age restriction on explicit material is not a new concept and should have nothing to do with support for anyone's sexual orientation. School libraries need to have reasonable restrictions. And not just school libraries. The actual lessons where these books are being taught in class is something I have more of a concern with. I mean, it's different. I still don't think you should have sexually explicit content in school libraries. But that's like, oh, if a student wants to read it versus a teacher forcing these kids in her class to listen to this weird short story about a mom shoving a pepper up her daughter's hoo-ha. It's so strange.
It's really crazy.
It's creepy. It is creepy.
It's very perverted.
It's very perverted and creepy.
Yeah, and I think that it's interesting that she makes the case that, you know, superintendents should be making these decisions, I guess, because we've had some superintendents lately that are making questionable choice or decisions.
Yeah, but also you can't say in one breath like that, oh, I think they can handle this, but you're also debating a bill that forces inclusivity learning right on all the schools.
But I mean, that's one person getting a job. I mean, you're not electing a superintendent. You're not this. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Her argument there. But that's why she didn't let anybody else talk.
Right. And she's like, nope, can't, no retorts. We're moving on. Lieutenant Dan 457. But he has a good point, and it's an interesting conversation. He says, so should education be something dictated at the local or statewide level? It has to be a mix. I think you have to have some standards across the board as a state. It can't just be a free-for-all for all these local school districts. You have to have some guardrails in place to protect against the crazy teachers, to protect against the crazy ideological school boards and superintendents, and to make sure that there's a standard of learning that you expect as the state of Washington. But in some of these other things where you're saying, oh, you have to have a certain amount of inclusive material around LGBTQ, around race, around all this, that's where you go too far. You're dictating too much what local schools should and should not do. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, banning pornography should be a statewide guardrail. I'm shocked we're even having the conversation. Why do we even have to have an amendment? Why do we even have to have an amendment prohibiting it?
You can't buy it until 18.
Nobody should be bringing it into schools in the first place. It's crazy. It's crazy, you guys. Oh, I'm so grateful for all of you because even though I can't see you or hear you, I know that you hear me. I know that we're on the same page, and it gives me a little bit of solace in this heart of mine that's shriveling by the day. With that, let's get to our closing sanity check. Heck of a week for Krispy Kreme donut in Seattle. There's like a shooting outside the one in SoDo by the stadiums that everybody who parks has to walk by. Not a surprise, though, in SoDo. But another incident at a Krispy Kreme up in North Seattle. It's the one that's on 125th and Aurora Avenue, also Aurora Avenue. Not particularly a surprise that you'd have some crime issues there. The headline from Como News, alleged fentanyl use in bathroom briefly shut down Seattle Krispy Kreme. In case you're wondering why your favorite Krispy Kreme on Aurora Avenue might have been closed for a short period of time, it was because someone smoked so much fentanyl in the bathroom that they had to evacuate the whole restaurant. Quote, I just knew by the smell and the odor and the stuff that was laying on the floor, there was something wrong, Solomon Keene, who works at the location, said. You could smell it. As soon as I walked over there and the door was open, there was this overbearing smell that came through my nostrils and I knew something was wrong. Yet that is the same smell and the same smoke that King County Metro want all of us to believe is completely unharmful if you breathe it in on public transit. insanity. That has been it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We appreciate every single one of you. If you have not supported our show already, we do ask you to do that. If you can, it's just $5 a month. It helps support our growth and our content, especially in this critical election year. We do appreciate every single one of you who has taken that leap and become paid subscribers. We will see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon.